Welcome to this Catholic Theological Union podcast. Today's podcast features a lecture by the Reverend Brian Massengale on the topic of Is Common Ground Possible in the Pursuit of Racial Justice? Father Massengale is professor of theological ethics at Marquette University. This podcast was recorded as part of Catholic Common Grounds Initiative Monsignor Philip J. Murnian Lecture, held at CTU on June 26, 2015.
Good evening. I'm grateful to the leadership of the Catholic Common Ground Initiative for the invitation to give this Murnian lecture. I'm especially so as I realize that the topic for tonight's lecture is a bit different from those of previous years. The Catholic Common Ground Initiative exists, and the mission statement is on the front of your green sheets. I did a little bit of research on this. The mission is to invite Catholics with differing views about critical issues in the Church to engage in prayerful dialogue for the sake of building up the communion of the Church. Thus, the focus of the Common Ground Initiative is intentionally intra-churchy. It is focused on, and this is from their 10th anniversary statement, on, quote, misunderstandings between liberals and conservatives, young and old, laity and clergy, rich and poor, academics and bishops. Stay tuned. But missing in this litany of concern is any mention of race and the racial tensions that mark our society and our church. Now, the urgency of contemporary events, the massacre of black worshipers in Charleston, South Carolina, the broiling controversies over the Confederate flag and the presence of racist symbols in our public life, and the continual killings of unarmed African Americans, especially young black men, by those charged with public safety, all of these demand that this omission be rectified and the topic be addressed squarely and directly. That is my aim tonight, by lifting up the provocative and troubling question, is common ground even possible in the pursuit of racial justice? Now, I'm going to address that question in stages tonight because I realize that the hour is late and some of us have eaten dinner and the flesh is willing, but the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. So, for those of us who are tired, here's what I'm going to try to do tonight. I'm going to first look at the signs of our times through remembrance of the deceased. Second, I'm going to look at the reasons for our present moment in racial justice in our country. Then I'm going to look at the state of Catholic engagement with the in reflection on the question of racial justice. Look at how we might move toward common ground, and then address the question, is common ground possible? For some of you who are students of theology, you may realize this is simply the pastoral circle: insertion, social analysis, faith reflection, and then call to action. Or for those of an older generation, it's basically see, judge, act. So it's very Catholic. Now, we may depart from the outline, though. That's going to be a Pentecostal moment. We're just going to run with it and let the Holy Spirit have its way, but then for good Catholics, we'll get back to the outline, okay? Everything in ritual and everything in order, okay? With me so far? Okay. With that, then, let's begin by looking at the signs of the times. As I wrote this essay, I am haunted, especially by the long series of tragic killings of unarmed African Americans, especially black young men, by police officers, security guards, and neighborhood vigilantes that are occurring with terrible frequency in the United States. We've heard the names, we've been acquainted with the headlines, but we don't always remember that these are real people, that these aren't just issues. They are flesh and blood human beings. There's somebody's brother, somebody's son, somebody's father. So let's take a moment to remember those who've been taken away all too soon. Trayvon Martin, killed February 26, 2012 in Sanford, Florida at the age of 17. Jordan Davis, killed November 23rd of 2012 in Jacksonville, Florida at the age of 17 while sitting in a 7-Eleven parking lot in a car with his friends listening to music, and someone objected that the music was too loud, went over to voice his objection, and then thought he saw the movement in the car, thought there was a gun, pulled out his gun, shot him dead, even though no gun was ever found in the car. Jonathan Farrow, killed September 14th of 2013 in Charlotte, North Carolina at the age of 24. Shot 10 times after he crashed his car in the middle of the night, rang a neighborhood door, neighbor's door. The neighbor panicked, called the police. The police came. He went toward the police thinking that they came to help him. Instead, they opened fire and killed him. Dontre Hamilton, killed April 13th of 2014 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, my hometown, at the age of 31. He's a paranoid schizophrenic who was sleeping in a park, disobeying no laws, breaking no laws. A police patrol came, checked him out, said he was no problem. Another police officer came and woke him up. Thinking that he was under attack, he started attacking the officer, defending himself, and the police officer pulled his revolver and shot him 15 times while unarmed. Eric Gardner, killed July 17th of 2014 in Staten Island, New York, at the age of 43, for selling untaxed, unrolled cigarettes. His last words while dying in an illegal police chokehold were, "I can't breathe," words that become a mantra, a rallying cry in the contemporary movement for justice. John Crawford III, killed August 5th of last year in Beaver Creek, Ohio, a suburb of Dayton, Ohio, at the age of 22, while shopping in a Walmart looking for a toy for his son. He walked around the store with a toy gun. Someone called the police. The police came, opened fire, and killed him. And his last words reportedly were, "But it's not real." Michael Brown Jr., killed of August 9th of 2014 in Ferguson, Missouri at the age of 18. Of the many details of this story whose headlines we followed, one that sometimes goes unspoken is that the body was left lying in the street for 4 hours in a hot August sun before finally being taken away. Akai Gurley, killed in November 22nd of last year in Brooklyn, New York, at the age of 28. A total innocent, he happened to be walking in the hallway with his son. And even the police realized that he was totally innocent, but the police were called there for another matter. A rookie police officer saw him in the hallway and opened fire and killed him. And even the New York police commissioner admit that the deceased is a total innocent who just happened to be in the hallway at the same time as the cops. Tamir Rice, killed in November of last year, at the age of 12, while doing what children do, playing on a playground, swinging in a swing, but he had a toy gun, and he was dead within 2 seconds of the officer's arrival. Eric Harris, killed April 2nd of 2015 in Tulsa, Oklahoma at the age of 44, killed by a Tulsa County Reserve sheriff who mistook his gun for a taser as he was laying in a sidewalk, losing his breath and complaining about this. He was told by the pretending police officers, shut the F up. Walter Scott, killed April 4th of 2015, this year in North Charlotte, South Carolina, at the age of 50. A Coast Guard veteran, he was shot 5 times in the back while fleeing from a police officer unarmed. And the officer was charged with murder only after a video showed that he posed no threat to the officer, as was falsely alleged by the same police officer. Freddie Gray Jr., killed in April of this year in Baltimore, Maryland, at the age of 25. He died after sustaining what they call a high energy impact while being transported in a police van in a practice known as a rough ride, when police officers transport prisoners at high speeds while being unseat belted, unsecured. In Charlotte, South Carolina, June 17th, 2015. Eternal rest grant unto them, O Lord. May they rest in peace. Lives ended too soon. While the circumstances vary, we see a disturbing pattern. We do not keep accurate statistics of police shootings in this country. We know how many police officers are killed in the line of duty, but we are not required to know how many people police kill in the line of duty. And so the statistics that we have are statistics gathered by grassroots organizations and activists who, looking at public records, can come at a rough guesstimate of the extent of the phenomenon that gathers us here tonight. What we see is that every 28 hours, at least 313, and that statistic comes from the fact that at least 313 extrajudicial deaths of black men occurred in 2012. Upon further analysis, we find out the following information: that 68% were younger than 31 years old, that 22% suffered from some form of mental illness or were self-medicated, which is significant because it raises important questions about how we treat the mentally ill in our society and how we train police officers to be first responders to our society's failure to deal with mental illness. Most were unarmed. 44% had no weapon at all. 29% were alleged to have had a weapon, but none was ever found, which means that 73% of these incidents involve no weapon. Only 20% had guns and 7% had knives, but only 13% had actually fired or used their weapon during the officer's presence or arrival. That was in 2012. But things have not gotten better with the passage of time. We still see a chilling drumbeat of repetition. In March of this year, police killed 115 people, according to the ACLU, mostly unarmed men of color, many with psychiatric disabilities. All of these situations are different. Each has different unique circumstances, and yet there is a disturbing pattern here, a pattern which was eloquently expressed by the New York Times columnist Charles M. Blow, who wrote in August of last year, "There is an eerie echo in it all, a sense of tragedy too often repeated, and yet the sheer, morbid, wrenching rhythm of it belies a larger phenomenon, one obscured by its vastness, one that can only be seen when one steps back and looks from a distance and with data. the criminalization of black and brown bodies, particularly male ones, from the moment they are first introduced to the institutions and power structures with which they must interact. This pervasive criminalization, even demonization of black bodies, it's what disturbs me. For it is an association that is not necessarily deliberate or conscious. One researcher, in studying the propensity of police officers to use deadly force more often in situations involving black people, rejects the conclusion that such officers must be either intentional bigots or completely unbiased. Rather, she notes something much more complex is at work. She says, quote, "Racial stereotypes operate at a subconscious level to influence a police officer's decision to use deadly force. The police officer may not consciously decide to use deadly force because of a suspect's race, but the suspect's race nonetheless influences the officer, altering the officer's perception of danger, threat, and resistance to authority." The Malcolm X Grassroots Association movement concurs, concluding that these deaths are the effects of a pervasive social conditioning. As they say, police recruitment, training policies, and overall racism within society conditions police and many other people to assume black people are violent to begin with. This leads to police overacting in situations involving African-American suspects. Or as I note, Dylan Roof, who massacred 9 people in a church, is still alive to face trial. The man who shot up a movie theater in Colorado is still alive to face trial. A 12-year-old boy playing on a playground is dead. But now, I want to make this even more difficult for us. You're saying, what? Hang on, you ain't seen nothing yet, all right? This pervasive social conditioning does not affect or involve only a few rogue police officers. That would be too easy and too comforting. These officials are not aberrations from a norm. Nor is Dylan Roof the confessed murderer of the Charleston Nine. At worst, they are exaggerations, but as I'm going to argue, they are representative of what is normal and typical in U.S. society. While some are implicated directly, they are not alone responsible. So one of the signs of the times that gathers us here is that we face a seemingly endless number of black lives being unjustifiably threatened, damaged, and lost, taken with a frightening callousness and apparent impunity. These have sparked cries for a new civil rights movement, one marked by the rallying cries such as, "I can't breathe," "Hands up, don't shoot," and "Black Lives Matter." Yet, as we will see, the civil rights movement is not really new. It's unfinished. It was never completed or fully realized. And this leads to the second movement of my address, lifting up the causes or the reasons for our current racial divisions and tensions. So why are we where we are? Why is racial justice still an issue that haunts our nation 50 years after the passage of landmark civil rights legislation? One of the most disturbing aspects of the events of last week in Charleston is that they happened not in 1963 when 4 young girls were died and a Birmingham church was bombed, but they happened in 2015. And they were captured not on grainy black and white videos, but in vivid color on our flat screen TVs. Why is this still an issue? And in some ways, a situation worse than that than existed 50 years ago. Of the many contributing factors, I'm going to lift up 4. 1, there has never been a commitment to genuine racial equality in our country. 2, the deep racial ambivalence on the part of the majority of white Americans. 3, the effects of the white bubble, that is, the pronounced white racial isolation and separation, all of which combine together to produce, 4, a form of racially selective sympathy and indifference. We all know the story. Now let's find out why we are where we are. Are you with me so far? Okay. You can tell this is a real Catholic audience, Catholic Common Ground, because I was just gave the keynote address at the Archbishop Like Black Liturgical Conference in San Antonio. They let me know I was with them. Mm-hmm. Tell it. Preach it. You telling the truth. Uh-huh. I'm with you. Don't stop now. Whereas in a Catholic church, you know you're with you when the missalettes don't move and the babies don't cry and everyone stares at you. However your cultural experience moves you to be present, just go for it, okay? There has never been a commitment to genuine racial equality. This is the most important and critical idea to understand for appreciating our current situation. This nation has never been unreservedly committed to the idea of full equal equality for black and non-white peoples. Now, this is not to deny that there have been significant changes in the racial landscape. For I can hear some of you objecting, but we have a black president, and you've got Oprah. I believe I hear that all the time. But the changes we see are in large degree surface ones only. The deeper struggle has never been fully joined. Now, I base this contention on prophetic insights articulated by the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. And I'm just going to put all of this up here right now so you can see where I'm going. Near the end of his life, King argued that the struggle against racism had taken on a new character. No longer was the enemy primarily the obvious brutality of enforced racial segregation. It was rather the more subtle forms of exclusion, racial privilege, and economic deprivation that nonetheless constituted no less effective barriers to full inclusion and participation in American life. He made this observation by contending that there were two phases to the civil rights movement. The first was what he called the struggle for decency. The second is what he called the achievement of equality. The first phase, which ended with Selma and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, King stated, was a struggle to treat the Negro with a degree of decency, not equality. Through hard work and sustained protest, the white majority summoned the moral outrage to achieve a consensus against gross brutality and coarse degradation. And that consensus endures today. But King observed that America had never been committed to helping African Americans out of poverty, exploitation, or all forms of discrimination. Once public decency and civility had been achieved and black people moved to the struggle for genuine equality, King found that many of their white allies, as he put it, quote, quietly disappeared, unquote. Moral outrage was replaced by what he called apathy and disinterest. In a word, indifference. Why? Move to the second column and a very last word. The major reason is that true equality is costly. Significant social change would cost money. Toward the end of his life, King pointed out that the civil rights struggle was divided into two periods. The first, he said, cost nothing. It cost nothing to desegregate a lunch counter or a restroom, a restaurant, or a public bus. That kind of change, he said, is bargain basement discount. But genuine integration, genuine equality, In other words, the ability to buy a meal at any restaurant you chose, ensuring that people had real access to quality education, eradicating inferior housing, eliminating the barriers created by centuries-long legacies of inequality. That costs money and lots of it. And Keynes declared that when the majority of white America looked at the price tag of real equality, they decided to settle for mere decency and improvement. This results in a fundamental ambivalence in white America regarding racial equality. A major study at the beginning of the 2000s, called The Common Destiny, described this ambivalence by noting that while most whites endorsed equality of opportunity in the abstract, they endorse it far less when equal treatment results in close or frequent contact or involves significant numbers of blacks or leads to blacks being promoted to positions of significant power and decision-making. In the abstract, we're committed to genuine equality, except when it gets too close or compromises power. So most Americans today are committed to the norms of interracial decency and respect, but there remains a fundamental ambivalence in the majority of white Americans. The desire to denounce blatant racial injustices and yet preserve a situation of white social dominance and privilege. To say it plainly, most Americans are committed to both interpersonal decency and structural inequality. Now, I wish I could take the credit or the blame for this brilliant insight, but it is one I also learned from King. In his last major work before he died, King commented on why the civil rights movement came to be opposed by the majority of white Americans. We can't forget that we glorify and honor King now more than he was when he died in 1968. He wrote, "Negro and white have a fundamentally different definition of equality. Negroes proceeded from a premise that equality means what it says, and they have taken white Americans at their word when they talked about it as an objective. But most whites in 1967, including many persons of goodwill, proceeded from a premise that equality is a loose expression for improvement." The "what more do you want?" White America, he observed, is not even psychologically organized to close the gap. Essentially, it seeks only to make it less painful and less obvious, but in most cases, to retain it. And he concluded, "The great majority of Americans are suspended between opposing attitudes. They are uneasy with injustice, but unwilling yet to pay a significant price to eradicate it." This fundamental ambivalence. In sum, the continuing resistance to racial equality, despite undeniable progress, can be largely explained by a fundamental ambivalence in the majority of white Americans. The desire to denounce blatant racial injustices and yet preserve a situation of white social dominance and privilege. In other words, to keep a normative white supremacy. So we're committed to interpersonal decency. We know there are certain words we don't say in public. That's why we all got on Obama for saying the N-word publicly in an interview, even though he's been called it over and over again on the internet. Don't believe me? Just Google Obama N-word and you'll see what I mean. But we're also committed to structural inequality manifested in the widespread disinterest and apathy toward racial disparities and the killings of unarmed black persons. This is part of our second, more difficult, and still unfinished phase of the civil rights revolution, creating a society of genuine racial equality, not mere decency and improvement. But now we have to look at a third factor that's part of our racial landscape, and that is that compounding the situation is the deep racial isolation of white people from the perspectives, hurt, suffering, and misery of their fellow citizens of color. The Public Religion Research Institute noted in a 2014 study that the chief obstacle to having an intelligent or even an intelligible conversation across the racial divide is that, on average, white Americans talk mostly to white people. Now someone said yes, okay. Indeed, they discovered that for 3/4 of white Americans, they have entirely white social networks without any minority presence. Now, I can't develop this point in detail. I'm just going to note in passing that what I call white self-segregation doesn't just happen, nor is it due to the racial preferences of racial and ethnic minorities. We can talk about that later during the discussion if you want. Now, this racial isolation has a profound impact. Namely, it facilitates a deep social indifference, ignorance, and even fear. It's the reason why you see such various different reactions across the racial groups to the events that we began narrating. The widespread social separation is the root of divergent reactions along racial lines to events such as the Watts riots, the O.J. Simpson verdict, and more recently the shootings of Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown. And then the study concluded, if perplexed whites want help understanding the present unrest in Ferguson, nearly all will need to travel well beyond their current social circles. Now, if the purpose of the Common Ground Initiative is to foster dialogue, one of the pastoral difficulties we face is that where do you begin when most of the people who need the dialogue don't have any natural point of entree for that dialogue to take place? And the final factor that explains where we are is a phenomenon called racially selective sympathy and indifference, which researchers define as the unconscious failure to extend to a minority the same recognition of humanity and hence the same sympathy and care given as a matter of course to one's own group. To break that down to plain English, it basically is the answer to the question, who gets the break, who gets the benefit of the doubt, and who bears the presumption of guilt and blame? Given their deep racial isolation, for many whites, the influence of the media, especially TV and cable news, becomes determinative of how they see people of color. And as a result, burning buildings and looting take precedence over a deeper analysis of the systemic causes and deep-seated grievances that occasioned the eruptions that unfold. And they further justify for many a heavy militarized police response and a lack of genuine commitment to racial equality. To illustrate this point, let's flash forward to Juror B-37. She was the first juror to give an interview after the acquittal of George Martin for the killing of Trayvon Martin. And in justifying her verdict, she speaks and she says, let me just get my point here, yes. I think George Zimmerman is a man whose heart was in the right place, but it just got displaced by the vandalism in the neighborhoods and wanting to catch these people so badly that he went above and beyond what he really should have. But I think his heart was in the right place. It just went terribly wrong. Note who gets the benefit of the doubt. Note who bears the presumption of guilt. George Zimmerman was just a man whose heart was in the right place protecting his neighborhood. Never mind that Trayvon Martin's heart may have also been in the right place of just trying to walk home and eat his candy in the rain. These four factors, then, explain in a great degree, among many that could be named, must be understood for appreciating our present divisions and tensions in our public life and in our ecclesial life today. Now let's turn to the church. Oh, you're getting interested now. Okay. Let's turn to the church. Now, examining and critiquing the Catholic Church's understanding of and engagement with the evil of racism is the focus of much of my intellectual and pastoral work, and my views have been developed in more detail in other places. Here I'm going to simply summarize the principal trends of the U.S. Catholic approach to racism and its alleviation. I'm going to highlight four features. One, its preoccupation with individual acts of conscious malice, which therefore cut both ways. Its principal reliance on a strategy of moral suasion or appeals to enlightened white conscience, that the solution therefore lies in having dialogue and education. Its dim view of African-American agency and initiative, and its self-understanding as a white institution, one that privileges European cultural values as being normatively Catholic. All of these factors taken together give a summary portrait of the dominant, even the official, Catholic approach to racial matters. So we've just sketched out the signs of the times. We looked at why we are where we are. So how have we as Catholics, you know, responded to this situation? Hang on. Catholic reflection on racism tends to focus on the more obvious and visible actions of racial hatred and exclusion. Even when Catholic leaders articulate an awareness, some awareness of the covert and systemic forms of racism, their attention is focused primarily upon voluntary, conscious, and deliberate actions of individuals. Thus, the official statements of our U.S. bishops, for example, reflect what I call the common sense understanding of racism, where racism means that person A, usually not always white, deliberately, consciously, and intentionally does something negative to person B, usually but not always black and Latino, because of the color of his or her skin. Focuses on personal acts of rudeness, hostility, and discrimination committed by individuals or at most by small groups of clearly identifiable actors. Also note that this cuts both ways. That's where the usually but not always comes in. That gives the whole thing about, well, you know, black people can just be as racist as white people. Okay. This is a reality, but it's inadequate to deal with the racial quagmires we experience in this country. What one does not find in official Catholic discourse is an examination or a critique of the underlying cultural beliefs or myths that facilitate or engender or legitimate racist behaviors. Let's look at this by a case study of what happened in New Orleans at the height of Hurricane Katrina. There was a major controversy that arose because there were two sets of photographs published at the same time showing people engaged in the same activities but being described in very different ways. In the top photograph, you see a young black man wading through water with a satchel behind him, and the caption reads, "A young man walks through chest-deep flood water after looting a grocery store in New Orleans on Tuesday, August 30th, 2005. On the bottom, you see two white individuals wading through water with satchels behind them, and that caption reads as follows: "Two residents wade through chest-deep water after finding bread and soda from a local grocery store." Engaged in the same actions, in the same place, neither paid for what they have. One described as looting, the other described as finding. Now, after a sore controversy, the photographs were removed, but once something's on the internet, it's never gone forever. But it wasn't as if there were editors who sat down and consciously said, "Oh, they're black, they're looting, oh, they're white, they're finding, they went on automatic pilot. But that's precisely what our official Catholic engagement with race does not highlight. The influence of pervasive social conditioning, which leads us to commit racism on automatic pilot. Racism without racist. This leads then to the second feature of Catholic discourse on race, and that is its lack of systemic analysis and overprivileging of calls for dialogue and understanding. Catholic social teaching today principally consists of moral exhortations and appeals to conscience. That is, the bishops presume that if the incompatibility of racist behaviors of Christian faith is pointed out to them, this will lead to personal conversion, which will result in personal and social transformation. In other words, if racism is a matter of people deliberately, consciously, intentionally doing something negative to other people, then you tell them not to do it. So the faithful are called to avoid using racial slurs or telling racial jokes. They're to challenge such behaviors among their family members, coworkers, and friends. Individuals are asked to cultivate interracial and cross-racial friendships. Catholic schools and teachers are called to develop curricula to foster cultural respect and toleration. Churches should offer liturgies of racial reconciliation. Catholic parishes should be safe places for interracial dialogue and open sharing. They should offer hospitality to those who are racially and ethnically different. One has the impression that the basic summons for Catholics is to treat those who are racially different with respect, decency, and civility. So let's see how this plays out in case studies. I know there's some bishops here, but again, I'm not picking on any individual bishop. I'm talking about us collectively. And I'm not saying this to absorb any bishop off the hook, because we'll see that what we're talking about here is something that's very endemic in American and Catholic society. If we look at the statement that the USCCB passed on race relations at their June meeting of this month, they passed a statement that was written by Archbishop Kurz, who's the conference president, in view of the unrest that's taken place in Baltimore and Ferguson. And they called upon Catholics, the conclusion of the statement is that how are Catholics to respond? This is what Catholics should do. Pray for peace and healing. Study the Word of God to better appreciate human dignity. Make a sincere effort to encounter different races. Make Catholic parishes more welcoming of families of different races. And get to know law enforcement officers and encourage young people to respect all legitimate authority. Disrespect for legitimate authority did not get people shot in Walmart or on a playground. The lack of social analysis here, there's no mention at all, reference at all, to the Department of Justice investigation of Ferguson, to the FBI director's report about racial policing. None of that was mentioned. The summons is again to pray, to study, to welcome, but no deeper analysis of the situation in which we find ourselves. The unrest in Baltimore led Archbishop Lori to issue a statement. When we look at his statement, he says he's calling for dialogue. His statement concludes, "May we unite in prayer for immediate and lasting healing, especially between members of our community and law enforcement, brought about by dialogue, mutual respect, and understanding. We pray that following today's funeral and the days to come, protesters will voice their views freely and openly, but without violence, which only deepens and prolongs injustice." But note the subtle blaming of the victim that's there, and no reference at all to the longstanding grievances that have led some to erupt in violence. And it concludes, "And finally we pray together that God will grace us always with his presence so that our broken city can once again be whole and that our minds and our hearts will be open to peace and love." I'm all in favor of peace and love, But the city was never whole to begin with. This again is a signal feature of Catholic engagement with race. The lack of systemic analysis and an over-reliance upon calls to dialogue. Because racism isn't simply or only a sin of ignorance, it's also a sin of privilege. A third feature of Catholic reflection on racism is a suspicion of African-American initiative and leadership. Over and over in our history of engagement, beginning in the 1950s and continuing to the present, we find that Catholic ethicists and moralists and Catholic bishops have been very suspicious of African-American initiative and agency. That the Catholic Church would rather encourage people to give rights to Negroes rather than to urge Negroes to press for the rights that are their due, otherwise we'd be encouraging fights and violence, quoting the eminent moralist John Ford in 1958. Unfortunately, this same trend continues even today. What you see before you is a cartoon that appeared in the archdiocesan newspaper, the Catholic Herald of the Milwaukee Archdiocese. In its August 24, 2014 edition, it published this cartoon depicting two African-American men wearing T-shirts, one with the words that have become a rallying cry for the city's protesters, hands up, and this is in the aftermath of Ferguson, hands up, don't shoot. The other man's shirt has a parody of this sentiment, hands up, just loot, and his upraised hands are carrying a 42-inch flat-screen TV, which presumably he stole. No other commentary accompanied the cartoon, nor was there any other mention of the events of Ferguson on the editorial page, no situating of this in the tradition of Catholic social thought, nothing, just the bald cartoon. Now, it prompted a furious outcry from the readership, particularly, but thankfully not only, from the Black Catholic community. I myself wrote a lengthy letter to the editor, copied to the Archbishop as his publisher, expressing dismay, sadness, and anger at the offenseless, tasteless treatment of the events of Ferguson. I noted that the caricatured, thug-like portrayals of Black men in the cartoon neither elicit sympathy nor engender understanding from the reader. Instead, they convey that the militarized police response to this community in the face of the protest was perhaps unavoidable and even justifiable. The cartoon oversimplified current events to the point of insult. I further noted the absence of any faith perspective or content in the cartoon itself. In response, there were a series of meetings that occurred with archdiocesan officials, the newspaper's editors, and community leaders from the Black Catholic community. In all these venues, the editors denied that there was any deliberate racist malice or intent in the cartoon's publication. They actively resisted any suggestion to the contrary. And when asked, well, why wasn't there any African-American or Black Catholic that you consulted to see how would this go down? And they said, I don't know. I don't know. This is symptomatic of the fourth and final feature of Catholic engagement with race. And I know I'm being very critical here. I don't aim to be critical. I stand before you as a Catholic priest, one that by the grace of God has been ordained for 32 years and serving this church well. But if we're going to move to a more adequate place, we have to tell the truth about where we are and how we've been there. The deepest reason for our inadequacy in looking at race is an operative ecclesial self-understanding of the Catholic Church as a white institution, or as I express it in my book, the sentiment that Catholic equals white. By white, I am not referring only to the racial designation of the majority of our members, but to our ethos and our locus of commitment. This whiteness was perceptively and bluntly described in the mid-1970s by Brother Joseph Davis, who was then the director of the Office of National Office of Black Catholics. That's not Joe Davis up there. That's Father Cyprian Davis. But Cyprian's work was so monumental, I had to get him up there anyway. Joe Davis wrote, "In analyzing the church's own documents, it's obvious that the church has always perceived its primary constituency as the white European immigrant community. On several significant occasions when the Catholic Church had the opportunity to depart from the structures of racism so rigidly imposed by the dominant society and to affirm the humanity and dignity of black people, it has invariably backed off in deference to the sensitivities of the white Catholic community." Or as I stated elsewhere, what makes the Catholic Church white is not merely the European roots of its liturgical aesthetics. Rather, it lies in the pervasive belief that European aesthetics, music, theology, and persons, and only these, are standard, normative, universal, and truly Catholic. Now let's see how this belief in normative whiteness expresses itself. The following reflections were offered when I was meeting with a group of church leaders and we're discussing a proposed pastoral letter on racism. One asked the question and said, "If we say, Father, what you want us to say, our people will get mad at us." A second raised the observation, "My people won't understand white privilege." And being the dutiful, obedient priest that I was, I noted all these comments, and I said, "Thank you, Your Excellencies. Your comments have been more helpful than you realize. But I have a question for you. When you say your people won't understand, whom do you mean? After all, I'm sure that there are many African Americans and Latinos and Native American parishioners in your diocese who understand exactly what is meant here and will welcome the document. So who are your people?" And there was silence at the table because they had inadvertently admitted what they believe but seldom express, that Catholic means white. A final case study of this occurred during Pope Benedict's 2008 Mass in Washington, D.C. It was at RFK Stadium, and the theme of the Mass was celebrating the cultural diversity of our local church. The reading was chosen from the Acts of the Apostles that described the descent of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost when all the world's peoples heard the gospel proclaimed in their own language. It was followed by a prayer of the faithful in various languages, by a presentation of the gifts accompanied by vigorous African-American gospel singing and Hispanic singing. And at the end of that, a commentator on a Catholic cable network that will not be named said, quote, "We have just been subjected to an overpreening display of multicultural chatter. And now the Holy Father will begin the sacred part of the Mass." That statement was never publicly challenged or publicly repudiated. And it showed that on a network renowned for its orthodoxy, a network that is the self-styled media presence of the Catholic Church, influential people in the church believe that cultural expressions other than European ones are not really Catholic or even sacred. This is the deepest reason why I believe our church has failed to undertake the actions needed to effectively challenge or fundamentally alter the marginalization of its members of color. These four factors, then, a focus on individual acts of deliberate racial malice, a strategy of education and dialogue, a dim view of African-American agency, and a self-understanding as being a white institution, are the major features of the dominant official Catholic engagement with racism and the need for racial justice. It's little wonder then that many black Catholics have described Catholic engagement and witness with the single word pathetic. The African-American bishops in 1989, on the 10th anniversary of Brothers and Sisters to Us, the pastoral letter on racism, they note that the pastoral letter on racism was soon forgotten by all but a few. A survey revealed a pathetic, anemic response from archdioceses and dioceses around the country. And then this guy named Brian Massengale in 2013 said that when we talk about race, the Catholic Church is a sad, dismal, tragic, and even pathetic history of race relations. And as a whole, the Catholic Church has not been courageous in addressing these issues. Let's skip over what we mean by pathetic. We'll just see what the words there. So, common ground. Given these realities in both society and church, what would common ground in the pursuit of racial justice look like? What would it entail? I believe it would entail at least five factors. The goal would be the pursuit of the beloved community. The second would be, we have to name the obstacle, is that white supremacy is a spiritual soul sickness. What's needed will be attentive listening as a prelude to lament and conversion and a deep sense of metanoia. And finally, that we would engage in what I call conflictual solidarity for the work of justice, realizing that social groups will not surrender their privileges voluntarily. So, a word about each. The beloved community. It's a protein metaphor in the African American culture for the kind of just society for which we aspire. One of its best articulators was the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who described it as an inclusive and interracial society characterized by freedom and justice for all. It's an integration that goes beyond a romantic mixing of colors, as he puts it, but entails a real share of power and responsibility. The mature King used another metaphor for the beloved community, speaking of a great world house where people relate across their differences according to the norms of love and justice. He writes, "We've inherited a large house, a great world house in which we have to live together, black and white, Easterner and Westerner, Gentile and Jew, Catholic and Protestant, Muslim and Hindu, a family unduly separated in ideas, cultures, and interests who, because we can no longer live again apart, must somehow learn to live with each other in peace." In other words, the goal is the creation of the beloved community. The goal is a commitment to complete the civil rights movement and its demand for authentic and genuine equality and not to settle for mere decency and improvement. The beloved community today is a commitment to a society where black lives matter, because when black lives matter, then all lives will truly matter. The second movement to our common ground is that we have to have a new diagnosis, that white supremacy is a soul sickness. That word is mine, that term is mine, soul sickness. We need to recapture the insight of the founding model of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, that the goal is to redeem the soul of America. And King declared that this would entail a profound revolution of values, the equivalent of America being born again. Now, there are many ways to understand racism as a political issue, as a sociological phenomenon, but at its core, racism is a spiritual crisis, a soul sickness. It's a profound warping of the human spirit that enables people to create communities of cold, callous indifference to their darker sisters and brothers. Stripped to its core, racism is nothing more or less than a disturbing interior disease that enables people to not care for those who don't look like them. Now, I have become convinced that as necessary as change social practices, such as better policing is, as necessary as body cameras are, all of these will be limited and ineffective without a deeper conversion, without attending to the deeper recesses of the human spirit that is the realm of religious faith and spirituality. That's the essential contribution that we as faith communities need to make. We need to name this as a spiritual crisis, a soul sickness. The third factor we need toward pursuit of common ground is we need to stress the need for attentive listening. If the Catholic Common Ground Initiative has taught the wider church anything, it is that a more whole and healed community is impossible without attentive, respectful listening and a willingness to be challenged by what one hears. We need to be attentive to the anguish of mothers and fathers who weep for their children gone too soon, and to black and brown parents who must have heartbreaking conversations with their sons. And what you see here is a script that happens in many African-American homes. Well, son, this is not the birds and the bees talk. This is about you coming home alive. While we know you're just a child, to some people you're an adult who's dangerous and guilty of something even if you've done nothing wrong. So if a policeman stops you for any reason, do what he says. If you can't make out what he is saying, don't go closer to ask. Don't pull out your phone to call us. Even if he yells at you or pulls out his gun and you get scared, don't run. Just put your hands in the air. No, this isn't right, but we don't have the luxury of being right. We want you home alive. When I showed this slide at the African American Liturgical Conference, I asked how many in the room had had a conversation like that with their children. And every black parent in the room raised their hands. When I asked how many have heard that talk, every black male in the room raised their hands. If we're going to achieve common ground, we have to have attentive listening to the pain, the anxiety, and the fear, and have the courage to ask, why is such a conversation necessary for some and not for others? Listening is a prelude for lament and conversion. Listening is important, but it's suspect absent the willingness to be profoundly changed by what one hears. Racial conversion is a paschal experience and entails dying to a false sense of self and a renunciation of racial privilege. It means an acceptance of difficult truths and a rejection of the half-truths and whole lies upon which we've built our personal and national lives. It's nothing less than a profound metanoia, as articulated by the noted evangelical social activist Jim Wallace, who notes that metanoia is not a mere feeling of feeling sorry or guilty. It's about turning in a new direction. It's about realizing you've been going in the wrong direction, and it's time to turn right around. And the final element toward common ground is that we need to undertake practices of conflictual solidarity. Catholic official teaching on solidarity is too often, a summons to the powerful to have a more proactive stance of care for the weak. It assumes that social elites will undertake practices of social dispossession and divestment of privilege voluntarily. It proposes a vision of solidarity without social struggle. But the African-American tradition is extremely critical of such an approach. Martin Luther King, for example, stressed the resistance and the recalcitrance that any call for social and systemic change arouses in the privileged, a resistance that yields only in the face of sustained demands, determined pressure, and ideological struggle. In justifying his poor people's march on Washington, he wrote, "We have not made a single gain in civil rights without determined legal and nonviolent pressure. For history is the long and tragic story of the fact that privileged groups seldom give up their privileges voluntarily. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed." If common ground is going to happen in the pursuit of racial justice, we have to accept that the acid test of racial solidarity is a willingness to engage in struggle. As Frederick Douglass reminds us, that struggle may be moral, it may be physical, or it may be both, but there must be struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did. It never will. But now we have to address the question, is this possible? Is common ground possible in the pursuit of racial justice? How realistic or likely is the common ground I've articulated? What hope is there for its realization? Can the church be something different? Does it want to be? Are we willing to do what it takes as Americans to become a more perfect union? I confess that I have been troubled by these questions, and I confess that I'm not so sure. I posed them to different people, and I've gotten the following responses. From a senior black Catholic priest, he said, "I don't think it is possible." A younger white Catholic theologian wrote me and said, "I hope Charleston will be proof for people who don't want to see, but I've hoped that before," followed by a sad face emoticon. Thomas Merton, the famous Trappist scholar and activist, wrote to James Baldwin about white Americans, and he said, quote, "I don't see any courage or capacity to grasp even the smallest bit of the enormous truth about ourselves." A white major superior of men, after hearing my workshop on white privilege, responded, quote, "Okay, I get that I have white privilege, but why should I give up a system that benefits me?" These voices give me pause. They echo the doubts and fears and hesitations I have. After all, we've marched and protested and boycotted and prayed and pled and bled for over 300 years. How long, O Lord? As I put it, I find myself caught between tense hope and realistic despair. But then I hear other voices. I hear James Baldwin's injunction, "You can't tell the children there ain't no hope." And I also hear Arthur Falls, a black Catholic physician, an activist, and a Catholic worker of the 1960s, who said, and I quote him, "You know, when you work for justice, you don't always lose." And I hear Malcolm X, who, when asked about the hope of a new relationship between blacks and whites following his pilgrimage to Mecca, responded with the word, "Perhaps, perhaps." That word sums up my response to this evening's question, is common ground possible in the pursuit of racial justice? As I find myself suspended between a tense hope and a realistic despair over the possibility of common ground. Perhaps captures the ambiguity and melancholy of the present, while yet maintaining that the future is not foreclosed and grace has a way of working in hidden and unforeseen ways. Perhaps expresses the blues hope of the African-American experience, conveying a disillusionment without defeat, a hope that recognizes the pain of the present and yet refuses to surrender. I conclude then on this note of a blues hope with the answer, perhaps, and offer you the concluding words of my text, Racial Justice and the Catholic Church. Social life is made by human beings. The society we live in is the outcome of human choices and decisions. This means that human beings can change things. There is nothing necessary or fated about racial hierarchies or white racial privilege. They are the result of human agency. It does not have to be so. What humans break, divide, and separate, we can also, with God's help, also heal, unite, and restore. What is now does not have to be. Therein lies the hope and the challenge. I thank you.
This has been a presentation of Catholic Theological Union. For additional videos and podcasts, or to learn more, please visit www.ctu.edu or visit learn.ctu.edu.